I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of plantyourself.com. So this podcast is about a lot of things. It's about food, it's about health, it's about nutrition, it's about science, it's about gardening, it's about the environment. But underlying everything is a word that I don't use consciously much, and that is liberation. But when I first thought about the words plant yourself, I was really thinking about planting ourselves, like putting our roots down deep into the earth, and being able to resist the crazy currents of our current civilization, not being swept along, not going along in the mainstream, but really putting down our roots and finding our true connections to nature and to our community and to ourselves. And that's why I focus so much on food, because you can't liberate yourself from a culture where you're dependent on its food chain. It's like a child running away from home and then coming back for three meals a day. You have to liberate yourself from the industrial food chain if you really want to liberate yourself from this crazy consumer culture that's destroying our souls and destroying our planet. Miyoko Shinner's latest book, The Homemade Vegan Pantry, is a cookbook. It's a book of recipes, of how-tos, but the underlying spirit behind it is one of liberation. It's a kind of punk DIY manifesto, and it says you don't need to be dependent on commercial products and packaging. You can slow down, you can unplug from this culture, slow down and cook, make your own staples, and get closer to the source of our food. And yeah, it's a lot cheaper to cook that way. She estimates that we could save maybe 70 to 80% of what we pay for commercial ketchup or commercial mac and cheese, even if it's the happy, GMO-free, organic, fair trade stuff, by just making it ourselves. We reduce our environmental footprint by having less packaging, and we get better tasting food. And we get to experience the joy of making food, of preparing things for our families and for ourselves and for our friends that contain our sweat, not literally, our love, our care, and our connection to the planet that supports us. So without further ado, Miyoko Shinner, welcome back to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Hey, Howard. It's great to be back.
Yeah, so last time we were talking about artisan vegan cheese, and you have a new book that's just come out. I'm holding it in my hand. It's beautiful. It's hefty. It's called The Homemade Vegan Pantry, The Art of Making Your Own Staples. And so the first question is, why? Why do you think it was important for us to, for anyone, to make our own staples? What are the reasons that we wouldn't just go out and buy stuff?
You know, I think it's kind of liberating to know what goes in your food and to be able to make every aspect of everything you eat. To be able to go into your kitchen and just sort of scientifically take apart everything that you would have previously bought and know how to put it together yourself, just in case. I mean, you know, what if there were a big, some nuclear disaster and you were stuck in your house. I'm kidding, of course, but you know, all you had was were cans of tomato paste and flour. And I mean, what could you do with that? It turns out you can do a heck of a lot. You can make ketchup, you can make mustard, you can make your own pancake mix, you can make all sorts of things very, very quickly, and know exactly what's going into your food, and really get creative with it as well, too.
Now, this week is a big week of transparency for me. I just hired a financial coach to kind of force me to look at budgeting and, you know, things and bills and bank statements and things that I like to avoid looking at because I don't want to see if there's any bad news. And your book reminded me that, like, there's a lot of things that I buy from the store that I would not make at home because if I made them at home, I'd have my face rubbed in, like, they're not good for me. Like, you know, like a packaged almond milk, which is, like, really high in sugar and it's got all sorts of additives. It's like I prefer to buy it so I don't have to deal with it. And this, you know, your pantry idea is kind of an act of sort of radical transparency and honesty, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, you know, the DIY, do-it-yourself movement is definitely growing at the same time that the opposite movement of just buying more and more packaged, prepared foods is growing. So there's really, really sort of, you know, two approaches to dining. But I really think ultimately we need to take control of our kitchens. We need to know what is in our food. And one of the best ways to do it is to make everything. It sounds like, oh my God, I'm going to be a slave to the kitchen. I'm going to be at my stove all day long mixing and cooking and all of this stuff. But it turns out actually that a lot of these things are super, super easy to make. It probably takes less time than to go to the store and buy it. You know, something like ketchup, if you have some tomato paste and some kind of sweetener and some vinegar, and salt, all you have to do is mix those up, and in 15 seconds you've got, you know, a couple of cups of ketchup. It's so easy. And you wonder, the cost of that is whatever it is, you know, 50 cents or a dollar or something, and you wonder, why was I spending $3.99 on organic ketchup? So a lot of the stuff you can make for about a third of the price that you'd be paying at the store, and you can make it so easily that, you know, you really just, it's a time savings also. It sounds hard to believe, but it's true.
Right. And in fact, the one dish I did make from the cookbook is ketchup, just because we were about out and I was leafing through it and I realized, oh, I got to go, you know, go to Whole Foods and find some organic ketchup without corn syrup. And it'll be like, you know, $4 in a plastic bottle that I'm going to then, you know, we moved out to the country. So now I got to drive to the dump. So that's another layer of transparency. Like I have to heft my waste and
right,
drive it somewhere. And, you know, I got out a small mason jar and just mixed this stuff in. And, you know, there's nothing to throw out. When it's done, I just rinse it and put it in the dishwasher.
You know, and that's a really, really good point. When I first wrote the book, actually, one of the inspirations for the book, and I actually included this in the introduction, but the introduction was too long and the editor cut it, but I started out actually talking about garbage, about the fact that I had prided myself on having, you know, ordering the smallest garbage can from our local garbage company and recycling and composting so much, and yet my daughter one day just said, which it was her, you know, it's her job to take out the garbage every week, and she said one day, why do we have so much recycling? What are all these containers for? And I realized that it was from all these things that I was buying, mayonnaise and ketchup and mustard and, you know, vinegar or whatever. I mean, I was just buying so much of these, so many staples, and they were just ending, they were just like that plastic ketchup bottle you just talked about. And so the question was, how can you reduce garbage and make things yourself in your own kitchen that are delicious, healthy, you know what's in it, you know, you can control what's in it. And not only that, what's really exciting about making your own staples is that ketchup that you made, if you don't like regular old ketchup, you can change it up by adding your own flavorings to it. You can add, you know, you can make it spicy Mexican ketchup by adding some chipotle and cumin to it, or you can make smoky maple ketchup by adding a little bit of liquid smoke and maple syrup instead of sugar or whatever. But you can add your own personal spin to a lot of these staples, which makes it really, really exciting. Once you understand what is the basic recipe, what is the basic formula. So,
yeah.
I think that's really liberating to know, you know, to be able to go into your kitchen and just put your own personal stamp on a staple.
Right. And, you know, the podcast is called Plant Yourself. And part of the way I think about that is we can each take a stand for a better, cleaner, healthier world with less dependence. You know, if we plant ourselves, we don't have to lean on the industrial food supply. And like most of us, or most people who are listening to this, I imagine, have let go of, you know, Little Debbie snack cakes and Lucky Charms and Coca-Cola and things that we would see as the epitome of what's wrong with our industrial food system. But there's still, you know, even like I sort of have a love-hate relationship with a lot of the companies that make vegan substitutes for, you know, meats and cheeses and other dairy products.
You're talking to one of them, yeah.
Well, yours is a little different,
yeah.
Right?
Okay, thanks. Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, a lot of the products on the market are highly processed, and they're not really made from real food. And that is, you know, like a lot of the vegan cheese alternatives that are on the market are a combination of oil and starch. So that's not really a food. I mean, last time I checked, you know, oil and starch weren't a food group. So if you are going to buy pre-made foods, at least try to buy foods that are real, that are made from real ingredients, you know, that come from either grains or legumes or fruits and vegetables or nuts and seeds. So they're actually real rather than just the byproducts of those foods. But, you know, of course it's wonderful if you can make everything, but, you know, we're also really, really busy, all of us. And so occasionally we are going to go and buy something that's pre-made, if, you know, especially if it's one of those harder things to make. But so many items, what I tried to do in the book is dispel the notion that making your own stuff is so labor-intensive and difficult. Once you learn a lot of the tricks that I have in the book, you find that, you know, if you just had a Sunday afternoon, maybe 3 or 4 hours in the kitchen, you could probably stock your pantry with all the staples you need for a month or more.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I noticed when reading through, and, you know, so a lot of the time when I read cookbooks, it's kind of aspirational. Like I just, you know, like entertainment, like I imagine myself making this recipe and it makes me happy. is the way you describe it and the way I was visualizing it is like, this is really fun. It's almost like going to art camp where, you know, like, you know, like a camp, like when I would, you know, make a lanyard, like that was like the
Well, it kind of is like that. That's a great way to put it. I love that description, really, because that's really kind of what it is. You know, it is kind of fun to know, wow, you know, mustard is simply just ground up mustard seeds with some kind of liquid. That's all it is. Wow. I mean, I can do this. And then it's like, hey, why don't I try adding this to that? Oh, maybe I can add this, you know. And once you know what the simple science is behind a lot of these age-old products, it's really kind of fun. And you feel very empowered because you can create it yourself.
And, you know, one of the things I realized is how liberating it is to deviate from the flavors you're used to. So, you know, many of us have imprinted, like when I was a kid, I imprinted on Heinz ketchup. And I remember, like, if we went to a restaurant and they had like Hunt's ketchup, it was disgusting. I couldn't do it. Like Heinz was the flavor that I wanted.
That's funny.
Or, you know, some people love, you know, Hellman's mayonnaise or
Miracle
Whip or whatever. It's like, and, you know, when we start cooking for ourselves, we kind of, you know, after the first like taste of disappointment, well, that's not exactly like the store-bought version. If you slow down, it's generally much better, isn't it?
I think it's much better because you taste the true flavors. Usually, you know, a lot of processed foods, it tastes good the first bite or right when it hits your tongue. But there's usually some sort of chemical aftertaste. And the more your taste buds become pure by eating a whole foods plant-based diet, you begin to pick up on those artificial notes. So they just don't taste as good. They don't taste real anymore.
That's definitely been my experience, where it felt like I was, you know, peeling away layers of tinfoil off my tongue.
Absolutely.
You know, where I could feel like, well, this is, you know, like I'll bake something or I'll make a soup and I'll go, boy, this is a little bit too salty.
Right.
You know, I really fine-tuned my own palate just by cutting out garbage.
Yeah, right. And that's what this, you know, you'll know by making your own staples, you'll know exactly what goes into absolutely everything. And, you know, I cover a whole bunch of different topics, everything from your own bouillon, making your own bouillon at home so you always have a soup base, and there's different versions of that, to different kinds of baking mixes that if you have kids and, you know, you need to make, I don't know, your kid comes home and says, I need, you know, some baked good for tomorrow's whatever, cupcake sale or whatever, you've got a easy to use baking mix in your pantry that you could turn into whatever, cupcakes or cake or cookies, you can make it whole grain or you can make it with all-purpose flour or you can use gluten-free flour. I mean, there's so many different options, so many different variations, but you've got something, kind of a go-to thing you can reach for.
And you start to see, when you talked about, you know, saving 70-80% of your food bill, you see if you just price it out, like one of those convenience packages, like a, you know, Whole Foods cake mix or something, or especially like the gluten-free baking mix, like a pound.
An organic one, $6.99, $7.99. You know, and you use it one time and it's gone. But you can make that. For example, I've got this great gluten-free buckwheat pancake and waffle mix in there, and you know, you can make a huge batch of that for, you know, $3 or something, and you've got enough for multiple Sundays.
Right, and the trick is then just sort of labeling and storage so you know what it is, right? Because to me, that's like the big advantage of packaged foods, is that it's well packaged. So I know,
what it is.
There's that plastic thing of ketchup with a classic shape. I know what it is. Your ketchup is in a mason jar with a lid on it. I'm like, what was that again?
What was that? You got to go you just have to put some labels on it. You know, masking tape is great. Just keep a roll of masking tape in your kitchen drawer, and you can just pull it out and just stick it on any jar, and you can write on it, and you can peel it off. You know, they even have the easy peel masking tape that you can get at Home Depot or whatever, the kind that doesn't stick to, you know, comes right off your wall. So it'll come right off your jar, too.
Awesome. So, that's one of the keys is, once you make it, to remember what it was that you made and where you put it.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah.
So one of the things you say in the introduction is one of the advantages of making your own staples is about the rhythm of cooking, the rhythm of food, the rhythm of your life. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think many of us now have this very, very sort of frenetic lifestyle, and we're just like bouncing off of walls all the time. And I really, maybe it's a romantic notion, but I really, really do find that when you can slow down just a little bit in your kitchen and make these things in an orderly manner, you know, and they're very, very simple. They're all really, really simple recipes. I think it just sort of, it grounds you, and you know, just like you were talking about the name of the podcast, it just provides this this calming rhythm that just takes away a lot of the stress. I mean, I find it almost meditative to make a lot of these staples. You know, to just spend 2 or 3 hours in my kitchen on a weekend. And just taking, you know, take inventory of what I have, what I don't have, and I'll go into my kitchen on a Sunday afternoon, and I'll just make a bunch of these things. And it's really it's kind of soul satisfying to know that now I've got a kitchen. My refrigerator is stocked with mayo and mustard and ketchup, and I've got a pantry full of all these other products. My freezer has, you know, various meat substitutes that I've made. I've got my soup stocks. It's all ready to go, and it's ready for me during the week when I'm really, really busy. I can reach for it, and it makes my life easy the rest of the time. So I find that it just kind of gives you this sort of, you fall into this natural rhythm where I think you're just more in tune with nature. I don't know if I'm being articulate at all there.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I have a very sort of romantic attachment to this idea of like completely going off the grid. I've gotten hooked on this sort of historical romance fiction series called Outlander.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you know about it. I don't know if I just went way down in your estimation, but I'm listening to the audiobooks. I'm on like book 5 or 6, and one of the constant themes they're talking about is just how hard it was, not necessarily how hard it was, but how labor intensive it was to live in, you know, rural North Carolina in the 18th century or rural Scotland, and just how much of everyone's day was devoted to food. Like even to the point where, you know, wars were put on hold so everyone could go home and like tend to the crops.
That's funny. You know, but that's been most of human history. I mean, as a species, and if you just look at wild animals in nature, they spend most of their time foraging or hunting or chewing. So, and that's what we did, you know, as we evolved throughout history. We spent most of our time foraging or growing or gathering or whatever, and then eating and chewing, and because we didn't have food processors and we may not have had access to heat and so much. So food took up a huge amount of our time as the human species and continues to take up a lot of time for animals in the wild today. This is probably the first time in human history where food is just something you do 3 times a day, and it really, you know, I mean, people don't even want to spend 30 minutes cooking sometimes. But then there's a backlash. There are people that are now getting into the kitchens more and more and just trying to understand, you know, they're rebelling. It's a backlash to all the processed foods, and they want to know what is in their food, and they're going in and trying to do things on their own. You know, there are people that are brewing their own kombucha, even doing more complicated things like making their own miso or their own soy sauce. I'm not getting that detailed in this book. I'm trying to present something that's more accessible to more people.
But there's pride.
I don't think this will take up all your time. What?
Yeah, but people who do that, they take a lot of pride in it. Like, you know, the first experience I had with this was I had some friends who were like doing their own homebrew.
Right.
And
they do. Yeah.
You know, this becomes artisanal. You know, like that's one of your brand words is like, you know, artisan.
Right.
Like, how wonderful for human beings. Like, how many people do you know who are artists? Like who think of themselves and who act and are treated like artists. Like for me, it's very few. And yet all of us have the opportunity to be artists in our own kitchens.
We do. We absolutely do. And that's what this is about. You know, it's not about complicated recipes. It's really kind of taking food apart and showing how to do each of these very simple things that we just taken for granted as being staples that you buy.
And there's for me, there's a huge sense of dignity in that. And I think we've lost it in a lot of our culture. There's not a lot of dignity around many of the jobs that people do. Like, they come out of college with debt and they got to go work for something and this seems all right. And it kind of uses some of my abilities. Whereas, you know, like when we go out and we pick our own blueberries and we make a meal from the food that we've grown ourselves, like that's transcendent.
That's satisfying. That is truly satisfying. You know, I mean, if you can grow your own fruits and vegetables, and then you make, you know, your own. I have a recipe for your own homemade butter. You make your own glorious butter, and then you make a baking mix, and then you pick your blueberries, and you make a pie crust with the butter and the pancake mix and the blueberries, I mean, that's truly satisfying because everything came from scratch. You know, everything is, you know, exactly what's in everything. I think it's really, really joyous.
Yeah, that's where I feel like, you know, there's as you said, there's always another level. So you didn't go into soy sauce, but somebody could. And there's lots of books out there about, you know, very, very advanced forms of fermentation and brewing. And,
right.
And sort of every level you go, it's sort of the opposite of hardship. Like this is the level at which you're getting more and more joy from it. Like, you know, like
that's exactly right. No one is saying you have to go. I mean, I have recipes in the book for things like tofu and tempeh, but no one is saying you have to make your own tofu. You can never buy tofu again. But once you do make the tofu, I guarantee you that smile will creep up on your face when you take a bite of that delicious curd. It's yep. absolutely joy. It's joyful. It's, you know, it's very, very enriching for the soul.
So let's talk about some of the staples. So you have a whole section called the meat of the argument, and you say meat is a term that should not just be reserved for animal flesh. So what are the meat substitutes that, or you know, non-animal meats that we can make, that we can have on hand, that we don't have to go and buy from the, you know, the deli counter at the local Whole Foods market?
Well, you know, the very first recipe I have in that chapter is actually what I call real tofu. And I know that sounds really strange, but tofu is one of the most delightful foods you can eat if you make it and it's fresh. It is unlike any store-bought thing you can possibly buy. There's such a delicacy to it that it's delicious just by itself with a splash of soy sauce. It's so utterly satisfying, and it literally is something that can be made in about 5 minutes. It's so easy. So I start off with that, and then I go into, there's also a recipe for tempeh, which is also completely delicious. It's so much better than anything you can buy commercially. Then I have recipes in there for different kinds of fish substitutes, which is something that, you know, it's hard to buy a vegan fish alternative. So I have a couple of different recipes for fish in there, fish sticks and unfish, and then I have some crab cakes in there. And then I've got things like vegan sausages, vegan chicken, vegan pork, that sort of thing. Some of them are soy-based. They're made out of either tofu or soy milk or yuba, which is a skin that forms on soy milk. Some of them are seitan-based. And then there's a couple of recipes that don't use any kind of seitan or soy at all. I've got these meatballs in there that are just made out of brown rice and lentils, for example. So there's a range of meaty dishes in there that you make in fairly large portions, and the idea behind that is you make one batch, a really large batch at one time, and then you can just keep it in your freezer and just pull out a small amount of it as you need for different meals. So that makes meal preparation really easy.
So if someone wanted to make their own tofu, what do they need? Do they need lots of special equipment?
No, you need a pot, you need a sieve, and you need some soy milk and coagulant, which is usually something called nigari, which is magnesium chloride. You can also use calcium sulfate, but magnesium chloride, which is a natural mineral, is relatively available. I mean, it's usually extracted from seawater.
And where would you get that?
You can get it online really easily if you just Google nigari, N-I-G-A-R-I.
Okay, and then what's the difference with this tofu, real tofu versus store-bought, in terms of like cooking it, putting it into, you know, sauces or pan sautéing it or, you know, baking it? What would people notice?
It has a delicacy and a freshness to it that you just cannot replicate with a store-bought stuff that's been sitting in water forever. You can make it as delicate in texture as you like or as firm as you like. depending on how much magnesium chloride you add and whether you press it or you don't press it. So you can also flavor the tofu if you want. So as you're making it, you can add, you know, herbs and spices, sun-dried tomatoes, olives, capers, salt and pepper, whatever, to just put your own spin and make a flavored tofu, a tofu that's infused with flavor already. This tofu is so wonderful. I highly recommend that you eat it by itself or maybe pan-fried or in a soup or something, but definitely don't, you know, puree it to bake with it or anything. It would be a waste.
Uh-huh.
It's so excellent. Of course, if you're going to make all your tofu, then of course you can do that. The other good thing about making your own tofu is that you have a byproduct. This tofu is coagulated soy milk. And so when you make soy milk, of course, you're removing the fiber from the soybean, which is called okara, O-K-A-R-A. And that's the, you know, that's the soybean pulp. So that can be used in so many wonderful dishes itself. And so in this book, I have several uses for it. One of them is making these great mock crab cakes, because okara has sort of a flaky texture. So it just really makes these fab cakes wonderful. Well, I call them fab cakes, San Francisco fab cakes, but it makes them absolutely wonderful. So, you know, once again, when you make your own staples, you can start out with, let's say, a pound of soybeans to make, you know, a couple of gallons of soy milk. And then from the soy milk, you can make a bunch of tofu, and you can make okara, and then you can make crab cakes, and you can make, you know, something out of your tofu as well, too. So you end up having multiple uses for just a handful of beans.
I've got to say, soy milk, you know, plant-based milks are a huge issue in our house for a lot of reasons. One is I don't understand how soybeans, which are like the ultimate commodity, like, you know, 3 cents, you know, for 50 pounds, whatever they are, you know, how that, like, a quart of soy milk in the store is $5. I don't understand how that ends up being more expensive than cow's
milk.
Well,
it's the packaging, it's the marketing. I mean, no one's marketing soybeans, but once it's in the form of a product, now you've got marketing expenses. You've got all the infrastructure of the company, you've got all the overhead. You got the packaging costs. You have the processing costs. So that's how it ends up being $5 or $3.99 or whatever. But if you just buy the organic soybeans yourself and just make your own soy milk, and I have a different way of making the soy milk in here. I researched it really, really thoroughly and to figure out what it is. You know, if you make your own soy milk at home, typically you get this really, really beany flavor. And a lot of people don't like it because they're used to store-bought soy milk. And what I found was that part of the problem was that most of the recipes for making soy milk call for soaking the soybeans in advance. And what that does is it releases this beany flavor. So by not soaking the soybeans and just letting them hit hot water immediately, I was able to eliminate most of that beany flavor that you get from homemade soy milk. So definitely, if you just buy soybeans, you know, if you really, really want to get into this and do everything from scratch, you can make your own soy milk. You can even buy a soy milk maker that I can't remember the name of the brand that I have, but I have a soy milk maker at home that does not require soaking the soybeans, which means that the soybeans go immediately, interacts with hot water immediately. So it's basically the method that I present in my book, except for the machine does it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can either do it just with a pot at home and a sieve and some cheesecloth, or you can get a machine that does it. But definitely, if you make your own soy milk, you save a ton of money.
Right. And you know, soybeans have been implicated. The way they are, the way they're hyper-processed for a lot of, vegan meat substitutes as not being particularly good for us. And here, you know, there's something nice with, like, you do it yourself at home, you know what the process is, you know exactly how fractionated the food is going to end up, and you can take the byproduct and make something else delicious from it.
That's right. So then you're getting the whole bean. You may not be getting it in the same dish, but you are getting the whole bean. So, you know, the crab cakes that I have in here have both tofu and okara, so you're actually getting a whole food. You just fractionated it first, but then you're putting it back together. So there's nothing lost at all.
Right. And, you know, our other family issue with soy milk is that, you know, when when I started putting the screws on my family, I was the dictator to, you know, to go plant-based. And so, and I did some things reasonably well, and other things I was very inelegant about. But like the, my wife's one area of holding out was tea. She's from South Africa, where tea is a religion. And of course, you know, you have your, you know, full, your full milk or cream in the tea. And when she switched to soy milk, it took a long time to find a soy milk that she liked. And she ended up finding this one brand. And our local co-op doesn't carry it anymore because they don't approve of the politics of the company. And I've got to say, I agree with them.
Right.
But now we're soy milkless. And so we're either going to some other place, buying this brand and holding our noses, which doesn't feel very good. So, you know, you've got something here we can try and get used to and like better than that packaged product, right?
Well, you can flavor the soy milk the way you like, but you know, for tea, I would recommend the almond milk and coffee creamer recipe I have in here.
Okay.
So you can make almond milk and coffee creamer at the same time. The only difference is the amount of water, and it's a whole food. It's just made with almonds and dates and a little bit of vanilla. It's really good tasting, and I tried all kinds of different ways of making coffee creamer, and I found that this was the simplest and the best tasting.
Mm. Yeah, so that's another thing I was thinking about is, you know, when people hear, when I first heard, oh, you know, Miyoko's got a book about making your own pantry items. So, well, that's going to be a lot of work. But pantry items traditionally have been, like, human beings have tried to figure out the easiest, quickest way to make it. And that's kind of the approach you take as well. You're always saying, you know, well, this is the traditional recipe, and I found that, you know, I could make jam in half an hour. Why do I need to strain it and lose all the goodness?
15 minutes. Yeah. It's like, why, you know, so a lot of these, you know, the idea of making staples is exactly what you said. A lot of people are intimidated by it because they think they're going to be now a slave to the kitchen. But what I try to do is liberate you. So if you just kind of rethink a lot of these staples, there is a really easy way to do it. Like my jams, I call it the easy cheat method. You know, you don't need to spend hours cooking down fruit and adding a bunch of sugar and a bunch of pectin to it. You can make it in a few minutes with whatever natural sweetener you want to add and as little as you want to add and just thickening it up with a little bit of arrowroot. It's really easy. It's kind of a no-brainer in a way. And nobody will, if you put it in a jar, nobody will know the difference.
So one thing I wonder about, you've got a lot of recipes that call for soy, a lot of recipes that call for wheat gluten. And, you know, those are kind of two big allergies. And, you know, at least people think they are. There's a lot of people, you know, the gluten-free is obviously a huge movement. A lot of people are told by their chiropractors and Chinese medicine practitioners that they're allergic to soy. I'm wondering if you find that the way that people don't react to pantry items, maybe the way they would react to all the processed versions of soy and wheat that they encounter.
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people, the whole allergy thing is something I don't want to tell people whether they really are or they aren't allergic to. I mean, there is a contingent. I think there, you know, it's at this point, it's almost fashionable to be gluten-free. A lot of people who say they're gluten-free don't even know really what gluten is. And there are those, I'm not making light of people that are truly celiac and have a real allergy to it, or even people that, you know, have really experimented and have found that they're gluten intolerant. But, you know, a lot of people really, really aren't. And I've tried to give options. I mean, there is a gluten-free pancake mix in here. There's a gluten-free pizza dough in here. And then there's also a, then there is plenty of ones where I just use flour unabashed, because I still think the majority of people in this country, you know, aren't having an issue with it, especially if you're using organic grains, and you know what else is in there. I know there are arguments about hybridized wheat and how the proteins have changed. You can use more of the ancient wheats if that makes you feel better physically or emotionally. I also have lots of recipes in here that really do avoid soy and gluten, but I personally don't. This is a vegan cookbook. It's not a gluten-free cookbook, or, you know, it's not an allergen-free cookbook. I've tried to provide different alternatives. Like, I've got three mayonnaise recipes in here. One of them doesn't have, a lot of the vegan mayonnaise recipes have soy milk in them, or soy, and one of them here doesn't have any soy in it. It's cashew-based. But then there's another recipe that's, you know, for the people that are oil-free, there's an oil-free mayonnaise recipe. So I actually have three mayonnaise recipes in here.
Right. I was very happy to see the oil-free.
Yeah. That's, I mean, it's really, really hard to satisfy everybody. You know, so I've kind of tried to, what I've tried to do with this book is to produce the best version that I can come up with of that product, rather than, you know, in other words, if I felt that gluten was necessary for something to produce a certain culinary result, then I used it. If I found that it wasn't necessary, then I didn't use it. You know, so I really try to take a more of a overall general culinary approach in terms of results, a result-based culinary approach.
And you also, you know, you've chosen to produce cookbooks, and your cookbooks, like, they don't hold back on, like, these techniques and secrets. You know, I've made a lot of cheese from artisanal vegan cheese, your last cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, it was amazing. And I'm very happy that your cheese, and we can talk about this maybe a little bit, your cheese company is going to be stocking shelves on the East Coast, because that was like a really, it took a lot of work to do a lot of those. So, you know. But I'm imagining, because you open source it, that people take your recipes and then a lot of people experiment and come up with different versions and tweak things. And sort of it's like a scientific culinary community where knowledge is always advancing.
Well, that's the whole idea. I mean, ultimately, you know, I write books to help people, because I want more and more people to go plant-based, to go vegan. And I want to give them as many tools as I have. I want to share those so that they too can do it. And it, you know, it's, for me, it's joyous to be able to share these recipes. So, I mean, even though I have a cheese company, there are four amazing cheese recipes in this book. And all four of them are oil free, I believe. So, there's a new melty mozzarella, melty cheddar, an amazing feta cheese that sits in brine for about a month, and then the shaved Parmesan. And I didn't put, you know, I was able to produce. Yeah, is there a Jack in here? I can't remember now.
Yeah, that's the one I dog-eared for first, the Jack with jalapeno.
Oh, okay, is that in here? Okay, I couldn't remember. So, you know, they are the ones that, you know, I was able to find that I didn't need to use oil for these particular recipes. And they worked. So, you know, that's what I tried in my own diet. I try to eliminate oils as much as I can. But occasionally, you know, if I want to have a slice of bread with what I call glorious butter, I do. And for something like a really, really good marinara, I just find that, you know, a little bit of olive oil really, really helps. I make oil optional on a lot of recipes. So I think I have sausages where the oil is optional. So I've tried to do that with a lot of the recipes here. So, you know, I try not to be dogmatic with my recipes. I just want them to, I want them to be a guide. So they're not exact things you have to follow, but they're kind of telling you how it's structured. It's like, this is the structure of a house. Now you can paint it any color you like.
Right. So let's talk about your cheese company. So you came out with artisanal vegan cheese. I guess you owned a restaurant, but mostly you've been an educator and a writer and a presenter. What happened? Did people say, like, how did you end up deciding I need to create a cheese factory?
Well, I did have a restaurant, and then after the restaurant, I morphed that into a natural food company. So I did have a natural food company for a number of years, which I sold, and we distributed nationwide to all the Whole Foods and things. So I had that experience behind me. But when I first wrote Artisan Vegan Cheese in 2012, I had no intention of starting any kind of company whatsoever. And people were always saying, oh, are you going to make the cheese? Why don't you just make it and sell it? And I kept saying, no, I just want to show people how to do it. I just want to empower them so they can make their own cheese. And I had no intention of doing it. And over time, though, people just kept asking me. And finally, I just thought, yeah, why not? Why don't I just do it again? But it just took me, you know, it took me about 2.5 years or so to get to that point where I thought I wanted to do it again. And I have no regrets. It's going really fantastically.
So I first tasted your cheese, I think, at a Vita Vegan Con a couple of years ago, and then I've had it at a couple of summer fests. And it's, I'm a little sad that I'm surrounded by vegans when we're tasting it. You know what I mean? Like, I would love it. Like, I remember when I was like 15, they had this big marketing campaign for Pepsi called the Pepsi Challenge. And everywhere you went, there was somebody with little, you know, blind taste test sharing Coke and Pepsi. I wonder if you've done those, or, you know, if you've put, if omnivores have had a chance to taste your cheese and be blindsided by the fact that it doesn't come from animals.
Well, it's interesting you ask this, Howard, because just yesterday a blog post by Robin Aspel came out where she took our cheeses and she invited a friend of hers who was a certified cheese professional with the American Cheese Society, and she invited her friend, the cheese professional, to taste all the cheeses and get her reactions. And she wrote an incredible blog piece about it. And the woman was absolutely, she was really, really impressed. And she, every single comment, she said there was nothing wanting, there was nothing lacking, you were totally satisfied eating these. So, you know, that was, I felt very honored by reading that. But, you know, we have had lots of omnivores try our cheeses. One of the reasons I wrote the book was because I had been serving them at omnivore parties for years. And a lot of times people just didn't even know that they were vegan.
So as you mentioned before we got on the started recording that you just hired a marketing director. Do you have any plans to kind of do that sort of like shock marketing? Because it really is shocking, especially, you know, some of like the soft cheeses, the ones that have like moldy rinds. You know, it boggles to think that these were, you know, creations of plants.
Well, what do you mean by shock marketing?
I don't know, like getting people to, like that Pepsi challenge. I remember I once went to a Bose store that make the speakers, and they had this demo where they had these giant speakers in front of the room and they were playing a video, and then they removed the giant speakers and you saw it was just plastic, and the speakers were actually the tiny little ones that they were selling for $200. Like, I just think that people tasting your cheese would be shocked. Like, you could actually cause conversion experiences. Because, cheese, as I think you wrote in the Artisan Vegan Cheese, is like the final frontier for people who want to give up animal products, but they can't give up cheese. There's nothing like cheese. And
oh, yeah, I see what you're saying.
There is something like cheese,
yeah.
And you make it. And so yeah. I'm wondering, you know, I would love to see just, you know, as I said, I love to be around omnivores when they taste this for the first time. And
we should do like a little video of that and just kind of and put it up. That would be fun.
Yeah. So what you said, yeah. this will be available on the East Coast for my
We certainly hope so. There are some stores on the East Coast that are already ordering from us directly. So if you go to our website, miyokoskitchen.com, there's a store locator, and there are a handful of stores on the East Coast. In fact, there might be something near you. I'm not sure right now. I'd have to – let me just go to your – what's your zip code?
27312.
27312. Let me tell you where – I guess there isn't anything quite near you right now. But, yeah, there are some places in – Pennsylvania and Maryland that are carrying the product, New York. So we should, you know, we'll be getting them definitely out your way ASAP.
Awesome. And, you know, when we talked earlier about, you know, the cost savings when you make your own, and obviously it would cost more to buy your cheese. One of the really nice things about making your own stuff is that you get to make that decision consciously.
Absolutely. The first
time I ever changed my oil and an air filter in the car, I'm like, I can pay someone $30 to do this. I stopped minding anymore. And, you know, so after making my own ketchup, I'm like, I'm never going to buy another bottle of ketchup. But after making your cheese, I'm like, wow, that took like 5 days, and there was a whole bunch of fancy ingredients that I had to order.
That's
online.
A little more complicated, yeah.
Like, you know, Miyoko, have the money, send me the cheese. But at least I'm doing it from a place of informed consent. I know what I'm paying for. I know that you have a factory, that you have a family to feed, that you have employees, that you have packaging and marketing, and that I'm willing to, you know, I'm willing to pay for that, as well as obviously supporting, you know, you're about much more. You're not trying to build an empire. You're actually doing, you know, a type of ministry and outreach through your cheese.
Right. Yeah. Yes. That's absolutely. You know, the cheese is something that a lot of people just. It's much more labor intensive. So the whole thing with making your own staples, you can pick and choose which ones you're going to make. You don't have to make all of them. You know,
like
and some things that are.
Go ahead. I say, like, if you had a company selling your homemade ketchup, it wouldn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I would make ketchup. That's too easy, you know. But the things that are a little bit more labor intensive, or that, you know, where the ingredients aren't as easy to procure, those are the ones that make sense maybe to produce. But, you know, the staples in the book are all made from ingredients that are just easy to come by. And that's the idea, is I want it to be accessible. I don't want it to be such a labor of love that you never get started.
Now, one more set of recipes that I'd love you to talk about before we end the call is your roasted tomatoes, which has your roasted tomatoes, and then it has two additional lives.
So that is one of the keys to the book, is that I don't believe in any kind of waste, and you can take anything, any vegetable or whatever, and use every single part of it. So with the roasted tomatoes, that's something that I discovered in Provence years ago, and I fell in love with roasted tomatoes, and I came home and I found a recipe for how to make them in my oven. This is years ago, kind of pre-internet, and what they told me to do was to discard the skins and all the juice which runs off when you make the tomatoes. But I tasted the juice, and I thought, my God, this is so delicious. Why would I want to discard it? So after you roast the tomatoes, you keep the runoff juice. Now, I call that tomato elixir, and that's fabulous to add to everything from pasta to risotto to soup. It just enhances everything. And then the skins that get all wrinkly and that you remove from your tomatoes, I process those with garlic, a little bit of olive oil, to make the most unctuous pesto imaginable, a tomato pesto that you can, you know, just stir into whatever you want, pasta, baked potato, vegetables, soup, and it just adds so much kick to it. So, the roasted tomato recipe is based on, roasted tomatoes are just roasted tomatoes, but what I've done that's different from all of the others is turned the skins and the juice, the runoff juice, into something else.
Right. So, as I was reading that, I was sitting at our kitchen nook table with about 8 pounds of tomatoes that are frankly starting to oppress me a little bit. Like it's not quite enough to do the full, it's not enough to, can 12 quarts, but it's certainly way more than I can slice on toast. And I thought, roasted tomatoes, juice for risotto, and skins for pesto, handled. Now I can actually have room to put down my plate.
Right. Absolutely. So.
So the book's been out for a little while, right?
It's been out for, is today Tuesday?
Yeah.
It's been out for about 2 weeks now.
Oh, wow. So it really is new.
That's it.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, it's brand new. Hot off the press.
Cool.
And it's doing really well.
Awesome. So do you have tours coming up in which you... Because I've seen you do your food demonstrations, and like nobody sells like you do when you give people your food. Your cookbooks are your books are always the one that are sold out at these, you know, there's like the big conference, and there's a room downstairs with thousands and thousands of books, and yours are the ones that are sold out first. So do you have shows where you're going to be sharing this, where people can come find you?
Yeah, well, this month I just did a book signing this weekend in San Francisco, but I will be going on a vegan Italian tour. Then I've got a vegan Alaskan tour in September. There's several Veg Fests. I'll be at Toronto Veg Fest this year, San Francisco Veg Fest, Sonoma Veg Fest. This is just for the next few months. I'll be down in Los Angeles later on in September doing some events. So there's a whole bunch of stuff coming up, and you can follow me on social media at miyokoskitchen.com or my Facebook page. I'll be definitely announcing all the places I'll be.
Awesome. And aside from running a growing cheese empire and giving talks, do you have another book in the hopper? Do you have any?
Yeah, I'm supposed to be working on a revised edition of Artisan Vegan Cheese, and I think I am way behind schedule, we'll put it that way.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Because I remember you did email, or I guess one of the VegFest, you handed out saying, here's the recipe for, I think, buffalo mozzarella in artisan vegan cheese.
Yeah.
And I've discovered a better one. So
I'm constantly improving recipes. And so there will be another revised edition of artisan vegan cheese coming out in the next year or two. And that will have some new recipes, better recipes, improved directions.
Awesome. So we shouldn't buy your greatest hits collection, because you're still making records.
Still, I don't know if there'll ever be greatest hits, because they're just gonna, you know, I'll constantly. Once I write a book, a week later, it's like, oh shoot, I should have written that instead.
Yeah.
So, that's how it is.
Right. Well, thank goodness for blogs, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Miyoko, thank you so much, first of all, for producing this. I feel like it's a book that should come with a challenge. Like, how much processed stuff can you get out of your pantry and fridge, and how much of this can you get in, you know, in the next 30, 60, 90 days? And so that's how I'm seeing this.
Well, that's a great idea. I should do a challenge like that on my blog. That sounds great.
Well, I'll be the first. I'll be the first to sign up, because it's so inspiring, and there's no downside. As you said, it's cheaper. It's actually quicker and easier. You talk about with the Glorious Butter, it's quicker to make the butter at home than to walk from the produce section to the dairy section.
Yeah.
Of the supermarket.
Yes, that's right. It is.
So, you know, like anything, you know, in this sort of instant gratification world, there's a huge cost to instant gratification, and there's a huge benefit to taking the time to doing things right and to doing them a little bit more fundamentally than just being dependent.
That's correct.
I am so pleased that this book is out in the world. I urge people to go get it. Even if you're a diehard Esselstyn T. Colin Campbell Wellness Forum fan, I went through this with that eye, because I don't use oil. I don't use processed fats, and I'd say about 85% of the recipes in here are perfect for me. So there's no one who can't benefit.
Thank you.
So thanks again for the conversation, and I can't wait to see the cheeses come out commercially, and I wish you happy travels, happy Italian vegan tour, and all the best.
All right. Thank you so much, Howard.
Be well.
All right. It was great talking to you.
You too.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Miyoko Shinner on homemade liberation in the homemade vegan pantry.
If you want some of the recipes before you buy the book, you can go to plantyourself.com and do a search for pantry, and that should be one of the first posts to come up, and you can see recipes for her almond feta, for unribs, and for her zippy barbecue sauce. So again, that's at plantyourself.com. You can search for Miyoko or pantry or zippy or any of the keywords that I mentioned, and it should come right up. So the garden was interesting this week. I was mowing around the edges, and I discovered a yellow jacket nest. And as much as I love animals, this was not one of those encounters that I look forward to. I was stung a bunch of times, and I bravely ran away without turning off the mower. And my wife decided to come and rescue me, and so she went there to turn off the mower, and she got stung worse than me. So we're recovering, which is also to say that tonight's class on salads to go has been postponed for a week. So if you're planning on coming to that in the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill area, it's not going to be on the 4th of August, it's going to be on the 11th. I've changed the dates in Eventbrite, so you can sign up for that if you weren't able to make this one. Other than that, getting a lot of patty pans. We are living on pesto pasta because the basil is so good. And some of the blackberries are starting to reemerge for, I guess, the second crop. So we're hoping for rain. Haven't had any in a long time. And I hope wherever you are getting all the elements in the right proportions and the right amounts and the right times. And as always, be well, my friends. Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize, all the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.